Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The Church of England picks the first ever woman to be the Archbishop of Canterbury at an especially hard time to be in that role.
The kind of more worldwide existence of the Anglican Church beyond the Church of England is very fractured and kind of hanging on by a thread.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll hear more about the new Archbishop. And in Egypt, rent control is going away.
Zone.
It's injustice, says this Cairo resident who's worried about eviction. Zimbabwe's plans to become a blueberry exporter and why the WNBA is full of global talent.
I kind of have this future vision. If I wanted to be the best, I have to be in America and I need to compete against the best because I'm not about to measure myself against people that are not on the top.
All that and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you so much for joining us today. The Church of England made history today by naming the first woman ever as Archbishop of Canterbury. Sarah Mullally will become the spiritual head of the Global Anglican Church when she's confirmed early next year. She had been the Bishop of London and before that a nurse. King Charles and the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer both welcomed Mullally's appointment, but a conservative group of Anglicans from across Africa and Asia said the choice showed that the English branch of the church is not fit to lead. That group does not support women becoming bishops. Speaking at Canterbury Cathedral today, Mullally mentioned Thursday's deadly attack at a synagogue in Manchester, England.
We are witnessing hatred that rises up through fractures across our communities. I know that the God who is with us draws near to those who suffer. We then, as a church, have a responsibility to be a people who stand with the Jewish community against anti-Semitism in all its forms. Hatred and racism of any kind cannot be allowed to tear us apart.
Karen O'Donnell is the dean and lecturer at Westcott House, a theological college connected with the University of Cambridge. I asked her if Mullally's appointment was a surprise.
To me, it was.
Okay.
I was talking with students yesterday and said, look, I don't think the church will do it. I don't think they'll go for it. I think they'll go for what's seen as a safe choice and another white man. And maybe the next time round it'll be a woman. So I was surprised, but I think she's a fantastic choice. She is an exceptionally safe pair of hands. And she already has experience in a very senior role. I think she's a great appointment. I was surprised, but utterly delighted and delighted that my church might be willing to make that choice at this point, which is fantastic.
I'm wondering why you didn't think that it would take that opportunity, why you thought it might go for a safer bet at this point in its history.
Well, I think the Anglican Communion, so the kind of more worldwide existence of the Anglican Church beyond the Church of England, is very fractured and very kind of hanging on by a thread. I think it's a precarious job that Justin Welby was doing during his tenure of trying to hold very different and disparate parts of the communion together.
The former Archbishop of Canterbury.
Now, I think Bishop Sarah is a fantastic person to try and hold that communion together. It's a precarious task. It's not a job I would want to try and do. But we don't necessarily always get the kind of news that we hope for out of our churches. And of course, the news I hope for and I'm celebrating over is news that many of my brothers and sisters in the Anglican Communion are despairing over. So nobody wins, or it's not a win for everybody.
Yeah.
In this.
Tell me about some of the divisions within the church that the new Archbishop will have to try to stitch together or find a way around. What are the big challenges she'll be tackling when she starts the job?
Well, I mean, the ongoing divisions are around gender and sexuality. So the global Anglican Communion is split over this question of whether or not women can be priests. It's even more split on the question of same-sex relationships. So there's one question about whether or not priests who are gay can be in civil partnerships or should be expected to be celibate. And then there's another question about performing marriages for people who are gay or LGBTQ, for kind of non-ordained people within the church. Bishop Sarah has been at the forefront. She's been the person tasked with leading that conversation through General Synod in the Church of England. So her views on it and her commitment to it are obvious to everybody. She describes herself as a feminist. That's going to really annoy some people. There's a bigger colonial question about what the Church of England is supposed to be and do, which I think somebody at some point is going to have to wrestle with why this particular version, this little church here in the UK, is still seen as the kind of spiritual leader of the global Anglican Communion. And there are very loud voices across the world questioning whether that tradition, that sense of kind of colonial power, is still something that's really important and should be upheld. And I think that's a question that will be asked again and again over the course of her tenure. She'll only serve 7 years. All priests retire at 70. And so I imagine these are questions that will trickle into the next person's leadership as well.
And the idea of, you know, this question around whether the Church of England should be seen as the leader of the Anglican community, it is different than, say, the Catholic Church, where the Pope is by design and formally the head of the Roman Catholic Church. Here it is called, what, the first among equals? So there is not this formal designation of the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Absolutely. And it would be a real mistake to read the Archbishop of Canterbury's role in a similar way to the role of the Pope across the Catholic Church. Certainly, it would be no mistake to say that she is very clearly the leader of the Church of England in England, but not of the whole Anglican Communion. There are archbishops in their own countries that will have significant leadership roles. And it's not a sense of kind of what she says goes for the whole of the Anglican Church in the way that one might understand the Pope's authority to work. It certainly doesn't work like that. First among equals, but of course, still seen as the spiritual head. So there's a tension in that I think is tricky to navigate.
Spiritual head, but this position is not just one of religious authority, but political authority, too. Mm. One of my colleagues described it earlier today as a job where you have the Bible in one hand and a newspaper in the other.
Yeah.
Can you describe what role the Archbishop of Canterbury plays in larger British life, even for people who maybe are not Church of England?
Sure. I mean, rather than authority, I would say influence. I'm not sure it's right to speak about her having a kind of political authority, but she will certainly have ears of influential people. She will, of course, be somebody who is listened to. So the Archbishop of Canterbury has a position in the Houses of Parliament, so the seat in the House of Lords. Sarah Mullally has already made her views on some of the political issues of the day. For example, one of the questions currently going through the UK Parliament is around assisted dying, and she has made her opposition to that very clear, certainly with her nursing background. You know, her experience gives us a sense of authority on that, as well as her spiritual leadership. So it's not an easy balance to hold. And some Archbishops of Canterbury lean very politically. Some try to keep themselves slightly more politically neutral. Who knows quite how her leadership will be expressed there. But this is not a ceremonial kind of role. You know, it comes with some at least influence, if not necessarily any kind of power to make those kind of changes.
Karen O'Donnell is the Dean and Lecturer at Westcott House, a theological college connected with the University of Cambridge. In one Swedish town, local politicians are nervous about what's happening inside a church. They believe the place of worship is being used as a spy hub by the Kremlin and want Sweden's national government to close it down. The parish is part of the Russian Orthodox Church. Its supporters say the church has become a victim of Russophobia. Terry Schultz from our partners at DW has the story from Västerås, Sweden.
Even before the Church of the Holy Mother of God of Kazan was built about 150 kilometers northwest of Stockholm, there were suspicions the foundation was being laid for the parish to participate in some unorthodox activities. To start with, its construction, which began in 2019, was funded largely by Russia's state nuclear agency. Then it belongs to the Moscow Patriarchate of the Russian Orthodox Church, which has actively supported the war on Ukraine. Plus, the priest had been convicted of financial fraud years earlier. For hybrid war researcher Patrick Oksanen, who was a journalist back then, there was no question this was not your normal neighborhood place of worship.
It is definitely a tool for Russian foreign influence. And it's a tool that could be used in soft ways, in soft power ways, but also into intelligence or even sabotage.
What made Oksanen so concerned was not only the background of the church, but its location, just 300 meters from a key airport and near the headquarters of some major companies.
It's a long runway, could be very useful for NATO support missions, and it's been used also for Swedish Air Force to do military practices. The second thing with the church is that it's situated in a way with a tower that is high, that could be used, theoretically, to put electronics to do either disturbances or picking up signals.
When Oksanen and a colleague started publishing their stories about this, one city councillor in particular took notice. Elizabeth Unell tried unsuccessfully to prevent the church's construction, but back then she couldn't convince her fellow council members the church could be a danger.
We were naive. Everybody was naive. And we couldn't think that this would be a question. But then we get more and more and more information after that.
The government agency that allocates funds to help support religions cut off the Västerås church last year after a stark warning from Swedish intelligence that said Moscow is using this parish, quote, to conduct intelligence gathering and other security-threatening activities. Frederick Brucey is a representative of that ecumenical agency.
Our decisions do not infringe upon your right to actually practice religion, so that you can still do freely in Sweden. But if the state is supposed to give you grants, then of course you have to be aligned with the Swedish state's values.
Finally, this past summer, the Västerås City Council decided the church's location was too risky. They backed Elizabeth Unell's proposal to ask it to move to another location.
It's not the problem to have a Russian Orthodox church in the right place, but it shouldn't be 300 meters from our airport. That's the big problem.
Russian ambassador to Sweden, Sergei Believ, says the city council decision is unfair to the church's followers.
It was not their choice where to build the church. It was given to them. Actually, Orthodox people from different places of Sweden come to this church. It's the only church of Russian Orthodox Church working in Sweden.
I wanted to ask some of those people what they thought.
We came here for Sunday morning services, hoping someone from church leadership would agree to come out and speak with us after several requests over multiple days. But they didn't. Most of the worshipers arriving here also would barely look at us. One man shook his finger in a clear sign to go away. A Russian-speaking woman called us spion, or spies. Only one young man agreed to speak with us.
We are obscuring his identity because he's under 18. He said he's proud to attend and defend the church and hopes the expropriation effort fails.
If they turn this church down, they are turning their back against the people who live in their city.
But it seems this conversation may have made the church turn its back on him. After speaking to DW, he tried to attend the services, but they would not let him pass through the gate. Others were allowed in. Elizabeth Unell says the treatment of this young man just adds to her concerns about this parish. The city's formal request to move it will be submitted this fall, and she hopes for a quick decision from the government. Terry Schultz, Västerås, Sweden.
Later in the show, a movement in France to stop barring kids from public places. We'll also explore the global blueberry economy. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. A court in Egypt has ruled that the country's rent control laws have to go. Under the old rules, which have been in place for decades, tenants often paid fixed rates that were set when their grandparents were young. That will be phased out over the next handful of years. With rents now allowed to rise quickly, some residents worry they will soon be priced out of a home. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Tucked away in a back street of Giza, a city on the west bank of the Nile, is the workshop of Hajj Adel. The 73-year-old listens to the Quran as he carefully stitches a torn leather suitcase by hand. Behind him, shelves sag with bags, belts and suitcases, his upcoming repair projects. Adel, a father of four, says he's been in this business for decades. He used to make good money, but now with all the Chinese products in the market, barely anyone brings in their bags and suitcases to be fixed. Back in the 1970s, he says, the rent was nothing, 15 or 18 Egyptian pounds. Since 2015, he's been paying £350. That's about $7. Affordable, he says. But since August, when the government announced the lifting of the rent caps, Adel says he's been worried about how much more he will have to pay. His landlord hasn't changed the rate yet, but it's only a matter of time, he says. It won't be easy, Adel says. We're on the margins of society, but I'm still grateful for what I have. In Cairo, Magdi Mohammed Kamel is finishing up sewing a garment. This is injustice, injustice, says the 62-year-old as he takes a long drag on a cigarette. I spent my entire life in this apartment, he says. I don't know if the owner will evict me. Where should I go, he asks. Under the new law, the government has created a complicated formula. If a family lives in Giza and in an area that's considered middle income, landlords can increase rents by 10 times. Each year, the rent increases 15%, and in 7 years, the contract ends altogether. The government says it is going to provide the lower-income families and the elderly affordable housing. But Araf Ibrahim, a taxi driver in Cairo, says he hasn't been given any details. The government says it will provide us with substitute housing, he says. But honestly, I don't know where we will go. I'm an old man with no pension, he says. I have blood pressure and diabetes. I can barely afford my medication. For landlords, however, the change in the law is long overdue. The old rent system was good for its time, says Omar, who only gave his first name. But the situation has changed a lot. The problem with the old rent is that most tenants pay very little. He says landlords can't even afford to fix their properties. Omar rents out an apartment south of Cairo that used to belong to his mother. She's passed away. He rents the house to an older lady who lives by herself. Her husband passed away a few years ago. It's tough for people like her, he says. I don't want to evict her, but I also don't want to miss out on the extra income. Omar says he will probably work out a deal with his tenant soon. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Starting tonight, the Phoenix Mercury and the Las Vegas Aces face off in the WNBA Finals. A few international athletes are likely to make an impact on the court. There's a question, though, about whether these global stars will end up staying here to play in the U.S. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Back in April at the WNBA draft, the league's global growth was clear as day.
The Seattle Storm select Dominique Malunga from France. The Golden State Valkyries select Juste Jochite from Lithuania. The Chicago Sky select Aisha Sivka from Slovenia.
International players made an impressive showing, many of them coming with experience, playing in professional leagues overseas. They've had great rookie seasons, but you won't see them on the hardwood during the finals.
Because it is very, very difficult to make the WNBA finals.
Howard Megdahl is the founder and editor of The Nine Sports and has covered the WNBA for over a decade. He points out that getting accustomed to the style of U.S. pro basketball can take a minute. And
the higher up you're drafted, chances are that team was not very good the year before, which is what led to getting that high draft pick in the first place.
One exception is Monique Okoa-Makani.
Put on the floor, Okoa-Makani answers!
The 24-year-old was born in Cameroon and is now the country's first player to make the WNBA Finals. But she comes to the league from France, where she grew up and spent 7 years playing professionally. Okoa-Makani's teammate here in the States, Satu Sabali, also played pro in Europe before coming to the U.S. On the podcast Bird's Eye View, Sabali said she knew as young as 14 what she wanted to do.
I always wanted to be the best, right? And I kind of had this future vision. If I wanted to be the best, I have to be in America and I need to compete against the best because I'm not about to measure myself against people that are not on the top, you know?
So while playing pro in Germany, she declined taking the salary in order to keep her eligibility for college hoops in the States. It paid off. She went to the University of Oregon and helped Germany's national team make its first Olympics. They won their debut game. Now, Sabali is a key member of the squad hoping to lead the Mercury to their first championship title in over 10 years. Journalist Howard Megdahl says the Mercury also have another international player to watch out for.
Sammy Wickram, who's able to come off the bench and provide tremendous three-point shooting.
Over to Wickram. Heat check.
You know, someone who has been doing that for Team Australia for well over a decade. You know, the international game is such a critical part of the WNBA itself.
Whitcomb is very used to the big stage, and this will actually be her second major championship of the year. Just 6 months ago, she led her team in Australia's pro league, the WNBL, to victory as MVP.
Oh, fading away, and bingo! Sammy Wickham having an influence in the third.
Even WNBA stars often end up playing overseas because they can earn 2 to 5 times more than what they get in the States. Players have been demanding more pay since the league launched. This season, perhaps more vocally than ever.
And before the game, the players came out without their warm-ups on with shirts that said, "Pay us what you owe us."
ESPN said its networks delivered their most watched WNBA regular season in history, and the league has been broadcast in 24 languages this season, 50% more than just 3 years ago. Players say their salaries aren't matching the booming business. They hope to reach a deal with the league before the collective bargaining agreement expires at the end of this month. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Stay with us for more stories from around the globe. This is The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The world has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. For almost a week now, young people across Morocco have been in the streets. This video from The Guardian shows a crowd of Moroccan protesters chanting, "Social justice, freedom, dignity, we want accountability." These youth-led demonstrations have brought a heavy-handed response from Moroccan authorities. The country's Ministry of Interior said three protesters have been killed and hundreds more have been wounded or arrested. I spoke about the protests earlier today with Aboubakar Jamai. He's a Moroccan journalist based at the Donna Dellen Manning School of Global Affairs in Madrid.
These youth are protesting because of the dismal state of the educational sector, the health sector, and also the judiciary system. These are the, I would say, the three main demands from this youth. They have been very vocal, and they actually made it very clear that they are demanding a reform of these sectors.
So they have these clear demands, kind of, I think, unlike some of the other Gen Z protests going around right now.
Yeah, I think there is a difference between this movement and the other incarnation of disgruntled youth protestation, which was the Arab Spring. I think it's important to link both of them.
This is when there were uprisings across the Middle East back in 2011.
Absolutely, yes. In 2011, the Moroccan version of the Arab Spring, which was called the February 28th Movement, the demands were very political. So they basically asked for regime change. They were asking for a parliamentarian monarchy, which would have been a regime change from an absolute monarchy, or at least an executive monarchy, which we still have, by the way. This is not the case today. And I think the reason that these youth are careful not to cross a certain line, it's because they know that the public opinion is worried that Morocco might go down the route of Syria, Yemen, Libya, etc. So basically, they are limiting their demands so far, because I think it might evolve, but they are limiting their demands so far to reforming these sectors. And they have a strong hand in demanding that, because there are strong data showing that the regime had failed managing these sectors.
Failed in what way? So why are the healthcare and educational sectors in such bad shape?
Well, let me give you some metrics. Morocco is one of the worst countries in terms of the internationally recognized rankings, the TIMSS ranking, the PISA by the OECD ranking. I think in one of the measures on PISA, we are the worst country literally in the world.
PISA is that standard, educational standard, a test, right?
Absolutely. And what's worse is that Morocco's situation is degrading. It's not only that it's bad, it's worsening. So even the dynamics are not good. Secondly, when we talk about the health system, the public expenditure, the health public expenditure in Morocco is around 2.3%, which is below peer countries and way below advanced countries. So there isn't enough investment. And also what makes things worse is there is this feeling that there is a rampant privatization, because the education sector is being privatized. We have more and more private schools. And the same thing with the health sector, by the way, which means that people have this feeling of inequality. It's not that the whole system is bad. It's mostly bad for them, not for the happy few who happens to be rich enough or close enough to the elites to be able to afford private schools or private hospitals.
Interesting. We've talked already about the Arab Spring in 2011. There were some ongoing protests in Morocco during that period, but it did not bring regime change, as you said, they were asking for, the protesters. Why not?
When the Arab Spring started, Morocco did not start from as bad a situation as the Mubarak regime in Egypt or the Ben Ali regime in Tunisia or the rest. Morocco was still considered as a pretty open system, not democratic, but a little bit more liberal compared to the rest of the region. So I would say that the willingness to change was a little less acute in Morocco than the other countries. So the time for the Moroccan regime to realize that the wave was basically building up, and the king had and the monarchy had the wisdom to immediately propose a constitutional reform. So the moment the monarchy proposed the constitutional reform, it kind of dampened the energy for change. The constitutional reform was not a serious one because the new constitution is not as autocratic as the old one, but is still very autocratic. And then basically, little by little, the authoritarian side of the regime regained ground and took hold of the system again.
So now, 14, 15 years later, there are protests again, people in the streets. We've talked about Morocco's neighbors in North Africa. Governments in some of those countries deal with dissent very harshly. What is the government's approach in Morocco to these protesters?
It is true that Morocco's reaction in general, compared again to our neighbors, is generally less harsh, but it's still harsh. In fact, the first instinct of the regime is to use repression. And it happened with this movement. The first day of demonstration, which was last Saturday, they were arresting everybody, which was a huge mistake because it radicalized the movement. And then when they realized they were adding fuel to fire, a couple of days ago, they decided not to repress this movement because you mentioned the fact that some youth had been killed. They were killed in a very special circumstances, not in the big cities. It was a rioting and looting. It was not demonstration. The big demonstrations are happening in the big cities. In general, in downtown big cities. So it's been now 2 nights during which the police is not arresting people. So people are allowed to demonstrate peacefully. And now the government has sent a message to these youth asking them to come up with requests and demands and to open a dialogue because they understood that their initial reaction was a wrong-headed one.
Interesting. So the government pivoting there kind of in real time as these protests are ongoing.
Yes.
Do you think that once the government gets these demands, there will be any substantial effort to meet them?
No, I don't think so. I think that the chink in the armor of this movement in terms of their demands, for understandable reasons, they are not talking about constitutional changes. But our problems are institutional and constitutional. Let me give you an example. They're talking about the judiciary being corrupt. Who controls the judiciary? The king. Now what will happen probably is that the government, the prime minister, will pay some price for what's going on. But as a matter of fact, the profound ills of Morocco's governance are related to the nature of our institution that basically involve the role of the monarchy, either directly or indirectly. We talked about repression. The king appoints directly the minister of interior, who's in charge of this whole aspect of governance. So when we say that the police is beating up people or killing people, these are people who are directly or indirectly appointed by the king, not even by the prime minister.
Abu Bakr, is it clear that you are no fan of the king and don't believe that anything will change while the king is still appointing political appointees in leadership positions in the country? Somebody who believed that there might be the possibility for change in Morocco, what would they say?
Let me tell you what I think about the monarchy. I think that the monarchy should play a role in the future of the country. Because if you are a believer in peaceful reforms, you want to look at the institution that can help you do that. And I think the monarchy has enough support, because what I'm saying does not mean that people are not supporting the monarchy. The monarchy has support with the people. But my problem is that the monarchy is not using this political capital in the right way. You know, the monarchy is involved in private businesses, and it's one of the main reasons why we have such a dismal private sector, meaning not enough jobs, etc. The monarchy is leading the judicial system, the security apparatus, again, with the negative consequences that we see. But at the same time, the monarchy can be a very important element into allowing a change to happen toward a parliamentarian monarchy, because if you're a Democrat and you believe that the monarchy can play a role, that's the only game in town. It's a parliamentarian monarchy. But the problem is, in my view, the monarchy is not acting in the wisest way possible to allow that. So if the monarchy is not pressured enough to change its way of governing this country, the waves will keep coming up until we'll have a tsunami, which we didn't have so far.
What are you going to be looking for in the next couple of weeks to see how this all goes forward?
Well, I'm old enough to know that it's very, very dicey to give a prognosis now. But I think that to me, the most likely evolution will be a much more gentle approach toward the movement by the government, frankly, depending on how it will evolve. Because one possibility, one option that I don't really see coming, but it might, is that the radicalization of slogans. So if these demonstrations that happen every single night today veer toward the more confrontational stances against the monarchy, then probably the regime will go back to its harsh ways to repress it. And then we'll have a vicious circle of radicalization and violence. So I think all possibilities are on the table right now. But probably what will happen is a much more benign attitude by the regime. And then after that, some formation of commissions, some firings, etc., etc. And then the regime will bank on basically what they think is the short memory of the public opinion. But it's, of course, it's not the wisest approach.
Abubakar Jamai is the head of the Donna Dillon Manning School of Global Affairs in Madrid. He's been telling us about the ongoing youth-led protests in cities across Morocco. In France, there's a growing kids-free movement in restaurants, hotels, and even campgrounds. Kids-free as in no kids allowed. Around 3% of venues are now adults only, according to official stats in France. Polls suggest that more than half of French people like the idea of keeping children out of more public places. But some say this anti-kid trend is dangerous for society. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Perpignan in France's southwest.
In Perpignan's old quarter, down a narrow alley lined with spice shops and fishmongers, there's a loud little sandwich spot. Here, a 30-something mom named Audrey is having lunch with her 10-year-old son outside. She tells me she gravitates towards noisy joints if she's eating out with her boy, because if he makes noise, she says, no one will notice and make faces. I dream of having a truly accepting place where we can go with our children, she says, where we can actually feel comfortable, because they're part of our lives, and it's nice to have them with us without feeling embarrassed. Embarrassed by kid stuff, maybe a kid banging a spoon on the table or throwing a French fry at a sibling, or, heaven forbid, throwing a tantrum. Audrey, who doesn't want to give her last name, says her boy is older now, so things are easier. But she says she'll never forget what it was like before. When he was little, she says, when he'd cry, it'd bother people. The same thing on the train or on a plane. But they're just little humans, you know. Little humans, but sometimes big noisemakers. Interrupters of the peace, some might say. 4 out of 5 French adults, according to a national poll this summer, agree that parents don't do enough to control their kids' behavior in public. And most like the idea of not having them seated at the next table or even on the same bus. Businesses are exploiting the sentiment, though not always openly. Under French law, it's illegal to discriminate based on age. Merci de patienter. But I ask around and find out about a nearby restaurant that's quietly catering to adults only.
Bonjour madame, je voulais savoir si le restaurant c'est encore un truc.
I call and ask if no kids is indeed the policy.
Oui.
Yes, a receptionist tells me.
Ça commence à quel âge?
What's the cutoff age? I ask.
Non, ça dépend après.
That depends, she says. An adolescent isn't the same as a small child. Little kids can be noisy, I say.
Voilà, c'est ça.
Voilà, says the receptionist. That's it. As to why this is happening, Sylvain Vagnon is an education expert at the University of Montpellier. He studies the role of kids in society. He says, first of all, there's a cultural norm in France in which kids are often preferred seen but not heard.
En France, souvent, on parle pas à l'enfant, on parle aux adultes, mais on parle pas à l'enfant.
He says, often in France, adults just don't speak to children, even if the child is right next to you. Adults speak to other adults. And there are fewer children to talk to. France's birth rate has been declining for decades. Plus, says Wagnon, towns and cities themselves have become less friendly to young people. There are more and more cars, not enough crosswalks. Kids are staying home, out of sight.
Si vous voyez un enfant, vous dites c'est bizarre, il est seul, qu'est-ce qui se passe?
If we see a kid out walking alone, he says, we might think, that's odd, maybe he's lost. The result, a vicious circle where adults have less interaction with kids, which leads to less tolerance of their, quote, childish ways. Bagnon calls this infantism.
Le terme d'infantisme, ça veut dire qu'en réalité, il y a une violence sur enfants.
Infantism is a sort of violence against children, he says, where kids don't have all of their rights. They don't have a place in society. The government is trying to regain that space for kids with an awareness program called Family Choice 2025. Sarah Al-Airi is France's High Commissioner for Children.
Partout, plus on laisse cette tendance s'installer, plus on a l'impression que nos enfants, ils doivent...
In this promotional video, she warns, if France keeps going like this, we'll soon have the impression that kids practically don't exist, or if they do, that they must be silent. The campaign asks restaurants to do simple things like provide high chairs for toddlers and harder things if possible, like create a play area for kids. The commission has also made a sticker for cafes and hotels with a little red baby carriage. Spot the sticker and someone on the street will know you can go inside with your kids and not get those stares or get denied service outright. But even that idea is generating controversy. On a Perpignan street, I meet a young woman named India Vanga Dasami. Ironically, she's out canvassing for an NGO called Infants of the World. It does things like fund schools and healthcare for kids in other countries. Vanga Dasami says when she first heard about the family choice stickers here in France, she was aghast.
Moi, ça me choque parce que c'est comme là, c'est en train de devenir comme les animaux.
That idea just shocks me, she says. Stickers to let us know kids can enter a restaurant, that's treating children like pets. Actually, at outdoor restaurants in the old quarter, pets are everywhere. Dogs straining at their leashes while their owners eat. People don't seem to mind the barking. As far as kids, on this day at least, there are none to be seen or heard. Nor can I find any of the new Family Choice storefront stickers. I reached out to France's High Commission for Children for comment, but have not heard back. At one downtown hotel called NYX, owner Robin Martin says he thinks he knows why we're not seeing the stickers around town. He says they'd send a terrible message to kids. If this place is friendly, what are places without the sticker like? Kids scream, Martin says. They cry. But that's life. Everyone was a kid once. If you're allergic to them as an adult, he says, then you're allergic to society. Martin himself welcomes families with children. In fact, in his lobby, there's a shelf with kids' toys and stuffed animals, including a pink unicorn. That sends the message, he says, better than any sticker. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Perpignan, France.
A 700-year-old city in Europe is trying something new. Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, is debuting electric riverboats on the Neris River. Loretta Lvulytė Staškevičienė is the CEO of the city's transportation department.
We are very proud of this project because we are looking in Europe and nobody else so fast did this project. So we are very thankful for our partners.
She was speaking to the Associated Press. The riverboats in Vilnius are sleek, 32-passenger catamaran-style vessels. They're not the only electric boats navigating European rivers, but they are among the first fully electric commuter boats. Vilnius resident Polina Ruginiena tells the AP it seems like a lovely way to get from place to place.
If you live in the center, in this area, and you work here, I guess yes. Especially maybe women would like it, like a romantic way to go to work or to clear your mind after work. I think it will be very cool.
Lithuania's environment minister is Povilas Poderskis. He says the new electric boats are being promoted as an environmentally and economically friendly public transport option. But they are slower than walking, he says. So he doesn't expect they'll be much more than a tourist attraction.
If we're not being honest about every single part of this green transformation, then people will be confused and in the end they will be disappointed.
The mayor of Vilnius, though, says slow isn't necessarily a bad thing. A full cruise on one of the boats offers scenic views of the historic city, so he's hoping electric ferry rides will bring more life to the river. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The global economic order is shifting in ways big and very small. One of those very small items being affected right now, the humble blueberry. The U.S. imports a lot of blueberries. Mostly here, they come from Peru. But China is actually the biggest blueberry importer on the planet. And China has just agreed to import blueberries from Zimbabwe. Not only that, but Zimbabwean blueberries will be able to enter China tariff-free. Valeria Pinheiro is a senior research coordinator at the International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington. She spoke from Argentina with my colleague Marco Werman.
It's been changing quite a lot, the market, in the last 10 years. Peru started out as being a very small producer. As you look at now, they are the biggest exporters. Zimbabwe, instead, it has less than 1% of the international market in terms of exports. I think that is 0.6. So right now, it's not going to move the arrow at all. But that's why I mentioned a lot about Peru and how it was a successful story, because they also started it from a very small number share. So it has the potentials to be more.
So there is this new agreement that will not only get Zimbabwe to send blueberries to China, but it's going to happen tariff-free, which comes as the U.S. is putting hefty tariffs on all sorts of imports. I mean, bottom line, how big a deal is this for Zimbabwe? Can you imagine blueberry economics evolving in Zimbabwe to the point that they're competing with Peru?
So potentially it could be very good, but they will have to have investments in the country to make sure that they can really take all that and make it possible. They have to work on regulations. They haven't even agreed on the sanitary conditions that they need to pass in order to sell to China. So that is one thing you have there. The other thing is blueberries. They require irrigation. They do require refrigeration to make it to the ports and so forth. Zimbabwe has to also take it by air or has to have some transportation. So it will add a lot to the cost. So it has the potential. It will employ labor that it is needed and everything. So it has beauties of making it happen.
I guess in the meantime, China is going to continue importing blueberries from Peru.
Yes. And now also what we're monitoring is what happens to the U.S. So the U.S., as you mentioned, it had now a tariff with Peru. So the incentive in terms of prices and efficiency to even export more to China.
Why would China have an interest in helping Zimbabwe ramp up blueberry production and giving them this tariff-free deal?
It's not only for Zimbabwe and it's not only for blueberries. It's a way of China to moving into Africa in saying zero tariffs. And it's at the same time that the AGOA preferential agreement with the U.S. is ending. So it's almost like now I think that Africa is this situation of how and what are we going to do in terms of our strategy with the global market and our own development strategy.
AGOA, that's the African Growth and Opportunity Act. So China is the biggest importer of blueberries in the world, and Zimbabwe is now part of the action. But Peru, as you said, it's the world's largest exporter of the fruit. Are there lessons from that incredible blueberry growth in Peru that Zimbabwe should learn from?
Yes, totally. I think that that's actually the key thing. So you had in Peru the dramatic export growth. You had the strategic public-private cooperation. You had also the geographic and climate advantages that it was leveraged in that case, which Zimbabwe can do the same thing. You had the improvements in productivity and the varieties as well. And working on the infrastructure and the logistics, then the policies and the incentives that have to be there in order to support this movement. And then last is to really look at how you handle the risk and the challenges that you will see when that goes.
I mean, it's an interesting little story about the blueberry, but it's really part of a larger shift in global food supply chains. What else and where else are you seeing this happen?
So another case that I think that is very interesting is the avocado, and Peru is also a key player in this. So it started as Mexico being a key player for China, but then obviously with integration with the U.S., it kind of that went down. And instead of that, Peru has been increasing quite a lot the share of the import market from China. But also you have now Kenya as a player. started exporting to China in 2022. It's still very small, but with this new preferential agreement and that they already have the market access there, so they have all the sanitary regulations already approved and everything, that could be something very interesting for Kenya and for the avocados.
Why do you think blueberries have become so popular?
I think for the nutrition's content and that they've been becoming more popular. It's like the avocado toast. Now, if you live in the U.S., you know, everybody's avocado toast. I don't know, I'm from Argentina, and avocado wasn't even something that we used to consume. And now you go to restaurants and they serve the avocado toast. And blueberries is becoming the same thing on top of the smoothies, no? Everybody now have also the smoothies. So I think that is more like the nutrition content that is very, very good. So people are looking for having more healthy diets and so forth. And that's why I think that it is still very localized in some countries, the countries that demand those goods, and the same thing for producers.
Valeria Pinheiro is with the International Food Policy Research Institute, where she is a senior research coordinator. She spoke with my colleague Marco Werman from Argentina. We're going into the weekend with a remembrance of music from Mali's celebrated singers Amadou and Mariam. The track is called Mogolu. That word, Mogolu, in the Bambara language of West Africa means the people. Amadou and Mariam were married and made music together for more than 30 years before Amadou died this April. Their distinctive music mixed traditional Malian sounds with rock and roll. On Mogolu, Amadou and Mariam sang about the human connections that emerge when we travel, bringing a message of peace, as Amadou and Mariam did for years. The World comes to you Monday through Friday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. And find more of our original reporting on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH. That's all one word. Be sure to check us out and subscribe. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a fantastic weekend, and we will see you back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Bill Resnick, Ron Cuniff, Deet and Paul Meserve, Patrice F. and Cameron J., Merle Kurtzrock, and George Zimmerman. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.